Tonight's lecture is all about headphones. Before we talk about headphones, though, we want to talk about what headphones are used on. They're used on these things. And you can see these things, which we all usually have two of, are very complicated. They're actually not that simple. There's all sorts of little places for sound to reflect, diffract, and whatnot. So that's going to be a recurring theme, that these are not simple like Omni microphones. These are actually complicated. So we looked at the external ear, now look at the internal ear. Here's the external ear over here, and you could see that there's a little like organ pipe resonance that could be set up over here. This is the rest of the mechanism. Basically, external sound comes in, is convolved through this sort of filter, depending on where it is in 3D space, travels down the pipe, and it goes through this mechanism, which is like a mechanical lever to activate the internal cochlear mechanism. So it's divided into three parts, outer, middle, and inner. And then the question is this a microphone? Does this look like a microphone? Clearly, it may not. Another quick definition of what headphones are. It's like speakers. They come in all forms. They're used for all different sorts of purposes, all different structures. So it's hard to pigeonhole them into one thing, even though we have an idea of maybe they're like those little white things that you see people wearing in the street. They're all different. There's a long history. They're used for different applications. So when we talk about headphones, different markets want different things. Most of the people in this audience want a really hi-fi, good-quality headphone. But that's not really true in terms of people in general. They're interested in other things. Now, why talking about headphones? Why are headphones hot? Headphones are really popular the last couple of years, and sadly, it's because of a company in Cupertino. It has a long history. It started out in the telecom world, where 100 years ago, you'd have people that actually plugged switches in and had these little headphones that were ancient history. But recent history has really started in 1979. If you remember, the Sony Walkman was a yellow cassette player. That was the real beginning, the opening shot in portable audio. Portable audio needs portable headphones. And so through a series of products, they got more and more expanded their market share. People started to get more popular with portable audio. Then they had a big problem. They bet the farm on something called mini disc. They lost it. Various technology things came around. And the company in Cupertino took off with the right product. Sony was effectively knocked out by this product. They followed up with a phone product, and now smartphones are the new platform for audio as well as video and communication. In fact, it's the new computing platform, but people happen to like to listen to music on it. Now, we're all very familiar with speakers. We have a couple good ones in this room, but headphones are not speakers, and there's a long list of reasons. This is only a partial list of why that's the case. I'll let you read the laundry list, but the most important point there is that you don't have a room. You're taking out the room interface. And so you have all these acoustical effects. As I'm talking to you, you're hearing my direct sound, but you're also hearing bounces, well, not so much off these walls, but off the floor and other places. In headphones, it's a straight shot in for most traditional headphones. Depending on what people's needs are, and what your needs are, the guy sitting next to you on the bus may have headphones that don't seal very well, and that's very annoying. The flip side of that, other headphones fit over the ears and seal very well, typically audiophile headsets, stuff that all of us, including myself, like to listen to. They usually seal very well, have great bass, and they don't leak sound out. But there's all sorts of parameters that are traded off depending on what people want at all sorts of price ranges. IHL is in-head localization, so when you put a headset on there, immediately that's a big difference. And there's all sorts of reasons why that happens, which we'll go into. The other two points that are maybe salient is that they really are good value for the money. If you have $50 even, or better, $200, you can get a really good pair of headphones. Where I think there's a slide in here later that compares headphones with pro products and consumer products. You really get a lot of bang for your buck. And the downside of that is they play really loud, really easily. They're very sensitive. Milliwatts go in, and a lot of noise comes out. And so because of this, a lot of people are going deaf, and there's actually some rules coming into play in Europe about how loud headsets can be. And we all suffer from this, no matter what you're listening to. If things are poorly recorded, they're going to sound bad. Okay, so here, when you measure there's a whole supply chain in headsets. In the test and measurement land, there's a company called Bruhl and Kjaer that sort of is the leader, and they have all sorts of ways to measure headsets. This is the current state of the art, which means it's sort of in the ballpark. And this slide is presented to show this is the approximate response of the human ear, more or less. This is only an approximation. And you can see right out of the gate, this is not a flat frequency response. Every other link in the signal chain, generally, the goal is a flat frequency response, unless it's like a guitar amp or something where you're really creating music as opposed to playing back. In the playback chain, yes?
Can you, the open ear frequency versus closed ear frequency, what does that
okay,
imply?
So part of that is that when you measure the ear, there's a couple different ways to do it. One is with a microphone, the best way, all the way pressed in near the eardrum. That is the best way because you get all of the effects of the outer ear plus the canal. That is the best way. Say if you wanted a custom head-related transfer function done, that is the way to do it.
That's where you have a microphone inside.
All the way in, touching the eardrum, or almost touching the eardrum. Not through it, though. That would be bad. Yeah. And then there's two other ways to measure. The other way is to put a microphone right here at the entrance. Actually, we can go back to that other slide. You can put a mic right here, which is the best way. But
And this is in humans, not in dummy heads?
Well, people, ideally, but you could do it in a dummy head. But dummy heads typically have a microphone here because they're a dummy. You can use all the space for the microphone, the mic pre, and all the other leadouts. So the best way to make, for getting back to the B&K, you can put a microphone almost near the eardrum, or there's two other ways. One is put a microphone right here that's small. And so that's a good compromise. The other way is you basically block off the eardrum with your microphone. So that takes out this last piece of the signal chain. And each is a little different. This is the best, and you'll see the peaks are the most pronounced, and but either way will get you in the ballpark.
Which one of those are open and closed?
Oh, when you have this blocked by like a microphone, that's closed. A compromise is having a small mic here. That's open, but you make a note that there's a mic not all the way at the back, and then a mic all the way at the back. That's the other way.
And that would be open? Like all the way at the back?
Yeah, that's open. And so the way there actually we'll go back to the measurement slide. There's at least three major ways to do this. One is where you take a headset and you take a headset you want to measure and seal it on what's called a coupler, which is sort of an artificial ear, tight. That's the old telephony way to do it, like when the Bell system was around. That's how they would do it. And that's a good way that's repeatable, actually excellent in production because it's consistent and repeatable. But over time, even the Bell system, which had a lot of smart people, realized that that's not good enough because when you take a receiver, when you pick up the phone and press it against your ear, it's not a perfect seal. So then there was 20 years of monkeying around to figure out how do you get some approximation of a loose seal. This will be a recurring theme where telephony stuff like that crosses over into more audio type stuff. And so there's various leaks and various mechanisms of anatomic anthropomorphic ear models, different materials, different softness, whatnot. It's still not an exact science, but this is near state of the art. And so it's showing that to a first-order approximation, the ear is not flat. It's not meant to be flat. The ear, especially at high frequencies, is a localization tool for survival. And it's not about hi-fi. This is the way Mother Nature did it, and she knows what she's doing.
So that's yes. Sort of the inverse of a Fletcher-Munson curve.
Well, a Fletcher-Munson curve deals with, as levels change, how does sensitivity vary? This is really... the way you hear is a function of a lot of things, and it's all nonlinear. But Fletcher-Munson in particular, which was done, again, at AT&T Bell Labs, tried to figure out how the sensitivity changes of the human listener as levels go up and down. And what they found is that we're most sensitive in the mid-band and basically have a low-pass filter in the low frequencies to keep body noise out, basically like your heartbeat, ear... blood rushing through your ears, all that garbage you want out of the signal, otherwise you'd be hearing it all the time. But as levels goes up, that curve flattens out nonlinearly. And so that's what that was about. That's the loudness button on your receiver. Yes?
Just make sure I'm reading that right. The ear is more sensitive. The open ear is has higher sensitivity at, what, 7 or 8K or something like that than at, say, 5 or a little above 5?
Yeah, there's two resonances there. And actually, once you get over 5 or 6K, it becomes very hard to repeatably measure that. Yes. But the answer to your question is yes, there's another resonance up there. And in fact, actually, all in the outer structure above 10K, there's all these little bounces and reflections, and there'll be other slides about that, that are not really about speech intelligibility. Above 12 or 14K, it's not about speech intelligibility. It's about localizing where... a predator is or dinner is, depending on which side of the equation you're on. Hopefully you're the predator. Okay, so this gets back to the question of an ear is not a microphone. We saw that just by the mechanical structure. It doesn't look anything like an these are cardioid, but a microphone that would be a measurement mic would be an omni-mic. It's a very complicated transfer function from an outside sound source to the ear. Non-trivial. It's not supposed to be flat, and it varies by the same speaker, say put in an anechoic chamber, in front of you as you move it around and then back and back around, the transfer function to your eardrum is very different. As you move it up and down this way and this way, it's all different. Very complicated, not like a microphone. So that mechanism is about localization and survival. Now, here's the in the red is what's beyond the test at the end. There will be a test. Headphones, most of them, almost all of them, mess that mechanism up. Because you're normally listening like this, and then you have a headphone that you wear that often crushes the ear. And you can even see if you're listening to music and you move around your ears, it's going to change. So that beautiful mechanism is screwed up when you put most headphones on. Yes, sir.
I don't think you expand HRTF there, actually.
Oh, that's what we have experts in the audience who've even written books, but that's a head-related transfer function. That describes what happens when a sound far away comes towards the body and is messed up by the head. That is, it's reflected and diffracted as the sound passes, typically, let's say, off to the side, around the body and goes to the ear that's in the acoustic shadow. That's one set of curves, frequency responses and other things. And if it goes more direct, straight into this ear, those are going to be very different. As that sound source moves in this plane and this plane, the curves vary significantly. It's not even remotely flat. The reason is you use that with vision to localize where dinner is or to survive. Does that sort of cover that? Okay. And that also is a big, that's non-trivial to get right, actually. Like loudness is also non, even the Fletcher-Munson curves, it's non-trivial to get that really right. Okay, yeah. Okay. Any questions? Feel free to interrupt. Okay, let's see. I guess what I covered earlier is that most headphones even good ones that will rest on your ears, mess up that beautiful piece of engineering. That, by the way, when you're born, you teach yourself through experience of your particular set of ears where things are. That is a learned behavior. So if someone cut your ears off and put new ones on, at first you wouldn't know where anything was, but you can relearn that. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but it is possible. And here's the last point there is something that's hard to get through one's head if you're in the Audio Engineering Society. But a lot of people don't want flat, don't care about flat. They don't want fidelity. They want big bass. They want loud. That's in particular, high sensitivity. They want isolation or no isolation to hear what's going on around them or to shut out what's going around them, especially in commercial applications like a call center where there's thousands of people answering the phone selling you stuff you don't need. Also, the intelligibility, which we will only touch on, that's a very important thing because there is loudness interacts with intelligibility and a bunch of other things interact to give you intelligibility. That is beyond the scope of this, but different headsets are for different things. And a good example is if you want to hear better what the other person on the other end of the phone is telling you, the frequency response that's shot for is not flat. It's a little peaked up at 3 or 4K. Part of that is because that will improve intelligibility. Part of that is also because there's losses in the old legacy system. There is an impedance roll-off at high frequencies, so they're sort of compensating for that. Okay, next. All right, so there are two ways to make these sort of measurements, two schools of thought. One is called the free field school. The other is the few school. The free field school takes a speaker, say, in an anechoic chamber right in front of you and measures what happens at the ear. And these are two variations. Oh, by the way, everything is out of the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. Everything is lifted from their august pages. A free field far away in a room that's dead. That's what these two transfer functions are. And there's two variations, open or closed ear canal. The other alternative to free field, because if you actually think about it, most times you're listening, you're not in a free field, you're in a real room, is a diffuse field. That is, you're getting reflections. And what that really means is that you're getting things spatially averaged. It's not just from one spot. You're getting bounces off the wall, ceiling, floors. And these are generally what people prefer, actually. When this is a reference, although there's many schools of thought on how to design headphones, this school of thought, looking at a diffuse field, generally people tend to like that. Although there's good sounding, good selling into professional market headphones with all different approaches.
So what is the standard for designing diffuse field headphones? If you were to construct the room that they represent, say, would it look like a round chamber?
Well, okay. The guy that's done the most work, Thiel, not the speaker guy in Germany, does a complete 360. That is, everything's averaged all the way around the head. That's sort of one extreme, the opposite of the free field where it's one speaker in an anechoic chamber. He's simulating a reflective room where it's all around. And he's driving that. He's the advocate for diffuse field being the way to go. And many companies follow that just because it seems to sell. But there's all different, it's like speakers. There's all different ways that people like and they'll buy different things. This headset is interesting, a Beyer DTA. That is the response of the headset. And that is a circumoral headset that goes over the ear. And it sort of has the opposite of the response that your ear gives it, the response of the peak. And it gets more or less a flat response to the eardrum. That is not how you hear, because you hear with that hump in the ear. But this is one school of thought that does deliver flat to the eardrum. So that's the exception to the rule. And Beyer knows how to build headsets. They have a long history since World War II of building very good headsets. In fact, most of the research comes out of Germany and Bell Labs in the U.S., and most of the best headphones are made in Germany and Austria for some reason. Here's another example. This is another headset that's electrostatic, we'll see later, held off the ear. Its response is also complementary to the traditional far-field response. And then here's some measurements of a bunch of speakers that also tend toward flatness.
On the stacks, it actually covers the ear, and it is a little removed. How far is considered just off the ear?
Okay.
Anything that's off the ear?
There's two types of stacks, electrostatic headphones. This is the famous company from Japan that builds very good products. One is, it's a circumoral that goes around like that but presses against the head. And there's one that copies the Austrian AKG, which I have pictures of both later on, that are held off the ear a little bit. And it's forward. When a headphone is held off the ear and it doesn't crush these things and it's a little forward, it's more like a speaker. It's more like a live sound. So it sounds very different, and many people like that a lot, actually. But there's no isolation and there's no bass because you don't have that pressure chamber to get bass. Like in a car, you can get great bass cheaply. In a headphone, you can also get great bass cheaply. As soon as you lift it away, you get all the magic ear interaction, and especially if it's forward or tilted in some way, but you lose almost all the bass and there's no isolation. And it looks kind of strange, actually. Let's see, what else do we have here that's relevant? The key thing on that slide is that the leakage, the lack of a perfect seal is really important because that affects how much bass you have. If you've got one of these big studio monitors that seal tight against the head, you get great bass. As soon as you start to get a leak, it goes away. And most headsets don't seal perfectly. This is sort of not particularly significant here. This is just talks about what's going on inside the pressure chamber. It's a small change in sound pressure, not significant in the big scheme of things compared to atmospheric pressure and the type of wave that's going on in there. Although this is not 100% right, it's not entirely a uniform sound pressure level. There is, around the leaks, there is a phase change, and it gets lower and lower sound pressure level towards the leak. In the limiting case, you have an AKG 1000 that is off the ear, and there is almost no bass, gone. Okay, next. This is interesting. So, if I do say so myself, the typical old school hi-fi headset for listening to stereo is rigid cups to seal out noise, and then a soft pad to attach to your head. That works pretty well, but you've created a spring and a mass that can rock this way, in which case you don't really hear anything, and can translate back and forth. And so you've already limited the ultimate fidelity because you have this outside spring and mass that can move around. And there is a limit to how much isolation you can get, because even if you have a perfect seal, like with a liquid-filled silicon a cushion and a metal, a heavy metal, say damp metal cup, the sound can come through the flesh and the rest of the body into your ear, and ultimately through bone conduction. So you'll never get a perfect seal. Oh, okay, we should have done this earlier, perhaps. This is just the anatomy of a headset. There's a whole bunch of different parts in there. We can see all of them. It's not exactly rocket science, except two. The speaker itself, we will see a picture of it later. Most of us are used to typically think of a speaker as a big woofer with a surround at the top edge, a cone, and then a spider, or the yellow ripply thing that you see to center the speaker, and then a voice coil and a magnet. You'll see in the pictures, which are coming up, that the architecture of microspeakers are very different. All the trade-offs you think you're making or you're used to in a big speaker are completely different in that. So that's non-trivial to get right if you're not familiar with it. And also the other thing that is not so commonly obvious is that because the leakage problem where you can't get a perfect seal, the counter design to that, and there's a slide on this, is to build leaks in ahead of time. That way, you've sort of controlled it. No matter what the positioning is, where there's going to be some leak, but an unknown amount of leak, you've already built some sort of leak into the system so it doesn't have so much of an effect as you reposition the headset slightly. And we'll see that in a minute. These are all the variables that are juggled when you're designing and building headsets and when you're buying them even. Again, air leaks, that's key. And then knowing how to put the acoustic resistance. Yes, sir.
Yeah, with respect to the seal and base leak and so forth, are you assuming an open back or a closed back?
Okay, good question, because an open back is an example of how the leak is built in a controlled way, so it doesn't much matter if it's not a perfect fit. The closed back typically tries to get a perfect seal, except when there's a venting mechanism in the cushion. And one next slide has that covers that a little bit with pictures. That's about it. Appearance also counts, depending on who's buying, and price, of course.
I've noticed the cable vibration a lot of times that you can actually,
yes,
if you just touch the cable, so depending on the headphones, you'll hear.
Yeah, that's right. Especially when you have the little headsets. Number one, you can pull them out of your ear if it's not a good fit. But there's the vibrations are conducted through the cable all the way back into your ear. Not good. You want some lossy coupling between the cable that's draped around the body and your ear. Otherwise, you're going to hear it. A bad design, you hear that right away. That's another good point. So you need to pay attention to the mechanics of that connection of the cable to the actual thing that's making music.
How can you get around that? What kind of strategies can you use? Do you like putting rubber in it?
Well, some sort of lossy coupling. Like you'll need, obviously the conductors have to flow through the copper wire, but even that is messed around with in the sense that you don't need a solid conductor. You can have like the leadouts from an LP, from a record player, if you remember those things that played the flat black discs. They're very flexible wire made of multiple strands, typically wrapped around something like silk or some synthetic fiber. Those are really flexible, so they mechanically decouple what's outside the earphone, what's in the earphone. The same is true in attaching microphones, the capsule to the rest of the body. You need to float the capsule, so you don't want a mechanical ground. So you want like curled around, lossy, super soft wires. You can do that in the headset, plus the jacket around the cable should be very flexible. So there's no hard mechanical ground. That's the way around that. It costs more money, though. Okay. Oh, okay. Here is how the architecture of different types of headsets. This is the typical audiophile headset that wants a really tight seal. Now, if you get that tight seal, you can get great bass and everything's fine and happy. However, if you don't get that seal, you see your bass will drop off a lot. So if you get it sealed properly, and some use the silicon molded liquid on the inside, especially in ultra high noise environments, you need that seal. If you're a helicopter pilot, it's extremely noisy. You want something like that is passively keeping out most of the sound as best you can. Here's an example. All the others are examples of designing a leak in ahead of time, so if it's not perfectly positioned, you're still going to be okay. So here you have relatively stiff cushions like here on the bottom, but then there is some leak built in as the headset rocks a little bit and opens up the pores. You have a way for some air to get out, and you always want some air to get out. Here, it's stiff cushions with a built-in rigid air leak that will always let some air out. So all three of these the goal is to not have a perfect seal. Here's another good way, is where around the speaker, around the periphery, you have what would be called an acoustic resistance or a permeable membrane that lets some air out and then it vents out the back. This would be an open headset. The downside of this is people can hear. That is, around you, people can hear. And, not everyone likes that.
So is there any equivalence to that in a port, in a regular speaker?
These are sealed, like sealed speakers, and these are like vented, but they're various types of venting. So you can vent in different ways, right? You can have a sealed speaker, which sounds great, but you can get more bass if you build in a port, which then has the air mass in that tube resonates to give you some more low-frequency output. The cost is the phase is shifted and the roll-off is faster below that.
I've heard from a couple different people, one that mixing is a very bad thing to do with headphones, and another friend says, well, actually, headphones give you a constant, so you always have a place to go back to. Is there any one of these schemas that would work better for engineering sound?
Well, first of all, both comments are right. Loudspeakers are great to mix for because most people still listen on loudspeakers, but that might change. As more and more people driven by little devices start to listen on headsets, they may have to start to at least listen to that. And a studio owner would know better than I, but since more and more people are listening to headsets, it also opens the door for binaural processing to come back, whereas you would specifically record, engineer, and process the music so that they sound good on headphones, but they will sound terrible over speakers. So that was the first comment. The second question about monitoring on headphones, well, if it's a constant, that's fine. It's like many studio monitors are actually, professional studio monitors are not particularly good. Actually, they break into two schools, the clear window through to what's going on and the smiley face, happy EQ that everything sounds a particular way. As long as they're constant, a good engineer, I guess, could use either one. So headphones are going to have their own quirks. If an engineer is used to that particular headphone, and there's one, by the way, that's particularly good, the new Sennheiser 800 or so, then maybe that would be a good reference to try. But as I understand this business now, people are not trading in their studio monitors. I mean, if you've got a good studio monitor, there's a few companies that build them, I don't think people will be trading them in. I think it's hard to on location, yes, because you're out in the field. Then that's the only way to go. But I suspect that people are not going to trade their speakers in anytime soon. Yes, sir.
So this is equivalent to doing the old mono mix for the car. That's going to change. You're going to do a mix for headphones now like you used to do the old FM mix for the car.
Well, I think you could do that because you could toggle signal processing on the fly probably to adjust your mix, just like you down mix a multi-channel on the fly from a DVD. If you've got two speakers, 2.1, 5.1, or 7.1, the DVD or whatever, Blu-ray these days, that player will on the fly give you different streams. Actually, all the data is in there. So it's possible that you can press a magic button and get something that sounds different or better or certainly preferable on a headset versus a speaker mix in your home.
I imagine if you were mixing for MP3 or, you know, one of those formats, you could almost guarantee that it's going to be played in headphones. You know, I would say probably 90% more times than playing in a stereo.
Well, there's a big market for that. Or they could have alternative mixes like a surround sound mix, a stereo mix, and a mono mix. Blu-ray has all of them. Or the ability to down mix on the fly. Mm-hmm. So maybe that way. Binaural is a concept of where you record on a dummy head with two microphones on a head that's sort of like a person, and you have left and right, and that's come and gone in popularity over the last 75 years. People like it, then they don't. Each time it comes back, it gets better, though. So maybe one day it'll stick, aided by the millions of portable media devices that people carry now.
just to insert something. So when you do a recording, it can be played on speakers or can be played on headphones. The headphones are a property of your playing device, your portable media player. So if there are some corrections to be done, they should be done by the device, not during the recording.
So the device would do the, like you'd have the...
And they actually do it.
The DSP on the device.
Even with a perfect headset, when you listen to a normal stereo recording, it's inside your head. Because this is how we hear. And to make it to be in front of you with headset, so this is exactly when those HFTF functions generic are applied. So at least the sound picture gets out of your head and stays in front of you. But this is something the device should do. Because the device is... knows, okay, I have designed it for headphones. I have to do those corrections.
And
yeah, go ahead.
From you're saying the devices do that now? Okay.
In most of the cases, yes.
How is it labeled inside? What do we look for on my iPod?
Your iPod for sure does it.
What is it labeled, though? Is it automatic? On
it's absolutely automatic. It's designed to be listening with headset. You'll get a worse sound if you plug it to normal loudspeakers. I don't like those iPod docking stations because you actually hear a processed sound.
So there's, if I might interrupt, then there's no menu selection where you say I'm playing my iPod.
I haven't seen it. Okay.
And from the point of view of a mastering engineer, I've been asked this before, do you do things differently depending on the delivery? Area, and my response has always been not at all. I do it as good as possible right away, because there are some people who, when they think they're going to be turning it to MP3, they'll already put it through a low pass filter at about 15K just so that the high frequencies don't really have to be kicked out. I personally don't agree with that at all. I like the full range all the time, and then that's for the lame converter, the MP3 processors.
Yes.
Let them do that. Sure. I'm not going to compromise the audio from the first one. Yeah. So it's reinforced.
That makes sense to me anyway. And in terms to your... Sir, go ahead.
No, finish your...
to your point about built-in processing to get it out of your head, the ultra-high-end outboard headphone amplifiers, which is a whole market for, actually, once you're willing to spend money, there's a couple like Meyer and a few, M-E-I-E-R, and a few other that have these, what's the Headroom.com has one that's cheap, where you have a switch to try some primitive cross-feeding to get it out of your head a little bit. Those aren't perfect, but there's clearly an attempt to do that. And a lot of the outboard headphone amplifiers have a button to press
with
for that.
Surround sound.
A lot of the true audiophiles, you know, the hardcore, they just want stereo, but they will sometimes push that button to see if they can get it outside their head. So there's a couple of the fancy outboard amps. I should have brought one. I have one. And by the way, that's the way to get good sound out of one of those crappy MP3 players, is to have an outboard amplifier and take the signal out from the bottom where it's line level and not go through the output chip. Then you can get really, really good quality if it's not a overly compressed format. Yes, sir.
What are the differences as you perceive? Because most people I know take the headphone output and put it into their mixer, put it into their sound system at home, rather than using an iPod port or whatever. But that's a very common thing to do at weddings or public meetings or whatever. What do you hear that's so different when you have that algorithm that pulls out in front of your head?
What is being done signal processing-wise to change the in-head localization?
Yes, and how do you perceive that when you play it through two loudspeakers?
It probably sounds terrible over loudspeakers because it's not for that.
He's a stereo effect. I think you have two channels and two speakers in front of you. Your left ear hears both left and right speaker. So there is a kind of mix. If you do the processing for the headphones and try to play this to the loudspeakers, you will have on your left speaker portion of your right channel, which means they'll be virtually closer. Yeah.
Yeah, a mono. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Wow, I didn't realize.
So it's electrically...
It's way more complex, but roughly this is how you'll still reduce sensor, reduce its stereo effect.
Everybody does that.
So it's an electrical cross-feed that simulates the acoustical cross-feed you get when you have air between you and the sound source, but it's got to sound awful. When you do that processing and then run it again through a speaker and you have additional cross-feeding, it probably sounds awful, not recommended.
And starting with
don't try that at home.
Media to begin with.
With crappy
like
media to write.
128 MP3s.
That's junk. Forget it. Yes, sir.
I was going to say a moment ago, Steve used, well, he actually used the word depending, but depends does matter here, meaning if you're in a studio, you're tracking, and you want to be able to clearly hear whatever it is you're doing, you might want a headphone that had that, you know, boost to mid-range. If you're doing editing, you, again, might wish to have that domain elevated, you know, so you can more clearly hear wherever the oopses are and so forth. So I think purpose has something to do with it all.
Fair enough.
The cross-feeding stuff that you talked about, that's related to the research that Ben Bauer did years ago?
God, he was a genius at CBS Labs, I think, who died early. I've seen some of his papers. I'm not fluent enough to comment on it, although, other than to let you know that he's done a lot of the seminal work in recording different cross pairs and separation, how to do that. That was his work. The other guy that died recently was Hawksford. He also did a lot of key papers. And the ambisonics guy, I forget his name.
Michael Gerzon,
another genius in recording. Those three guys did a lot of the key work.
And didn't he start Waves or something?
No, I don't think so. Waves is the signal processing company?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. I've met those guys. They're not academics at all. Let's leave it at that.
Marketing type of, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, sorry. I use the products.
So. Yeah, they're good products. I've used them, designed them into products also, the chips. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Waves was in the first dock for iPods, was the InMotion from Altec. That used a Class D amp and a Waves chip to get more apparent bass, because there was no bass in these 2-inch speakers.
Yeah. Max bass.
Okay, so
Max bass.
It's available as DSP or as a chip. So now the question is, what's the goal here? Again, what are we trying to do? What is good? I guess we've heard already enough comments that depending on what you're looking for, it varies. There's no simple answer. Just like speakers, there's all sorts of everything from, you know, really big expensive speakers, studio monitors, to little tiny ones that sit beside your PC. So it's whatever you're looking for, everything is available. Those are the things you generally want to look for. These numbers are based on I actually tested a bunch of speakers to see, well, how are they really measuring? And these are not perfect metrics either, but these are a good place to start. These are the things that typically sound good in a speaker. And just even these distortion THD metrics, these are not so good metrics, but given that that's what you're looking for and that's what all the test equipment's set up for, that's a good metric. And this last one is sort of a special one that Dean Jensen invented at Jensen Transformers. It's a multi-tone test. It was the first sophisticated one. Multi-tone test goes into a device under test, and all the cross products come out. So all the nonlinear distortion products, nonlinear meaning it's not a harmonic of the tone you originally put in. So you put in 10, 12, 21 tones in, and you get all the sums and differences of all those different products. So you have all of these, this garbage that's not related to the original signals. That is a very good metric for sound quality and clarity and even articulation in the mid-band, not commonly done. AP recently copied that in Fast Test, and it's starting to catch on, but it's non-trivial to do right. That is an excellent test for quality.
So good in this case is not very much?
Good spectral contamination means if you put a dozen tones into the device, you will see all the cross-modulation products in between those tones. Think of a bunch of 12 tall trees, and the grass grows up between those trees. If the grass is high, especially in the mid-band, that product's not going to sound good. In fact, I did that so much that I didn't have to look at the graph. You can hear it without looking when a speaker's bad. And I did that myself on 20 studio monitors for Mix Magazine, and you didn't even have to look. Once they put that tone in, if it sounds a certain way, you know the measurements are going to be terrible. The reason you do this test is a lot of speakers pass these easy tests. THD is low, especially at low levels. The two-tone intermod is low. So if it's total junk, it'll fail the easy test. If it's good, you separate the excellent from the merely good with more sophisticated tests like that, done at a variety of levels. A tenth of a watt, 1 watt, 10 watts, 100 watts. That quickly sorts out the wheat from the chaff.
Is that a
a device that's doing that?
That's just a technique. It's just a technique that Dean Jensen invented. It's in an AAS paper, and there's a follow-up paper by an engineer at PV that worked through all the mathematics to figure out what are the best frequencies to use. These tests really work to sort out something that's, you know, good from something that's excellent, because there are not a lot of good tests for that.
Did you find an excellent speaker?
Sure.
Can you name one?
I could. I can name two, actually. The JBL Pro Studio Monitors and the Genelec Pro Studio Monitors. Not the cheapest ones. What's that?
Those are expensive.
You get what you pay for. There are a lot of home products that are 10 times the cost that don't test as well. So the JBL Pro is 1,500 lists per each, and the Genelec is about the same. And they're powered. They come with amps for free. How can you beat that? And there's nothing in it for me to say that, but those products were the best by far. And that's what we bought at our new lab. We bought 5 of those JBLs. The other one to consider was Genelec. So I selected 5 of those, put someone else's money where my mouth is.
And that's drawing old JBL 4208s with the potbelly pig kind with the titanium domes.
Yeah, well, I'm not a fan of titanium domes. We can take that offline.
Okay.
There's 2 schools of thought on that. I'm not a fan of that. And we could talk about
Let's
why that,
that
is.
Let's do that sometime.
Yeah. Okay.
Was that work published?
What's that?
Your tests of all of these?
In Mix Magazine with the studio monitor test about 5 to 10 years ago now, Mix Online. They should have some of the reports still there. There's other tricks to do that. Offline we can discuss it if you want to do that yourself. What else we got? There's lots of ways for a transducer like a headphone or a speaker to screw things up. This is just a partial list. Now, there's test equipment from a company called Klippel in Germany that is very good at measuring non-linearities in the suspension, the magnet systems. There are other ways to do it, too much or too little power. If you're a mechanical engineer like I am, the properties of the diaphragm become very important and understandable, because a diaphragm is supposed to be stiff, yet light, yet also well damped. Not a lot of materials fit that bill. Titanium is stiff, light, shiny, so that's nice, but it's very poorly damped. Aluminum is better. And there are other metals. Beryllium is stiff, light, and well damped. It's just very expensive.
I found that nylon sort of sucks as compared.
Which one?
Nylon. The nylon domes.
A lot of those are not so much nylon. What are they?
Kevlar?
Kevlar sometimes has a sound to it, actually. That's another offline thing. For compression driver diaphragms, there's a whole bunch of materials. We could definitely talk about it later, because I worked in that end of the business, and materials for high-end product.
After the break.
Absolutely. The other things that also go wrong and make headphones sound bad, and I work in this area now, and so unfortunately I know that in my own products, is that if adhesive joints are bad, if the voice coil is not exactly centered, because if you think about it, and we'll see in a slide, I'll go back to show you why that's important. You see this? This is the geometry of a microspeaker. It's attached here, right? There's no surround elsewhere, but at these tips, what's there? A voice coil. That's how it would work. But look at it from the point of view of a little tiny microspeaker. You have a very thin polymer diaphragm, and hanging off that diaphragm is a metal coil that's relatively very heavy. It's very hard to control that. In a regular speaker, you would have a voice coil, and there would be a joint here of a second part of the suspension to keep it going straight. It's very hard to keep a coil with only one-point suspension moving straight. So a lot of times it will rock this way or that way and scrape against something like a pole piece, whoops, and it will sound bad. A lot of ways that things go wrong. That's a talk in and of itself. We can go on and on about that. But the point is that it's very hard to do those microspeakers right.
In that last slide,
yes.
All of the 4 pictures, one more.
Oh, sure.
One more bag. One more.
Yeah.
Why are some of those square to the ground surface and others are slanted?
Okay.
They're squishy.
So these are showing that when it's a bad fit against the person, for whatever reason, that there's always going to be an air leak built in. And here there's going to be, this is a compressed foam, and there's going to be a lower resistance for air to come out. And the design intends that to happen, because if you have a seal design like that, if it's not perfectly sealed, all your bass goes away. Also, there's a sort of occlusion effect where if you're wearing sealed headphones for a long time, sometimes people don't like that. And it's exaggerated in the headphones that are in your canal. If it's truly sealed up and occluded for a few hours, some people don't like that. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, which of these are the flat foam, like those Sennheisers that just sit on top of your ear?
This is just illustrating the sealing principle with one, with circumoral style, with one style, keeping that only variable here is this part. That what we'll go over other part. We'll go through all the different types, well, not all, many of the types of headsets in around 10 slides, if you can wait. Okay, where are we? Test and measurement. Okay, so this I touched on this earlier. Originally, you would take a headset, just like you'd take a handset from telephone world. AT&T would develop this stuff, and you'd cram it on a sealed coupler. No leaks, perfect seal. Not realistic. It's evolved. It's regularly evolving. The latest one are these three vendors, B&K in particular, and Head Acoustics, are up to version 3.3 and 3.4. The type of coupler between the headset or the handset and your test gear, your AP or whatever, your pulse or whatever system you're using. Each time, each iteration gets more and more realistic to the way people really use headsets. And now it's actually switched to cell phones are driving that. Because anyone have an idea of how many cell phones are built every year? Take a guess, anybody.
Lots,
yes, that's what's driving. And but anyone have a numerical guess? Go ahead, no penalty. Huh? Yeah, a little over a billion. So that's a lot. So that's driving the tests. The tests are driven by, the equipment is partly being driven by the need to test handsets for cellular telephony. What else do we have? Yeah, this here's that point. That's a lot of product. So testing that, making that sound good. And also a cell phone, there is no seal with a cell phone. So right away you see that you need to build, there's a lot of leakage. Okay, what else we got? Oh, here are some measurements of the Stax headset, which I have a picture of. Actually, I'll show you the picture first. These are the Stax, and these are the AKG K1000s. These are held off the ear, and they are tilted, as so it's as if a sound source is coming to your ear, and they also tilt in other directions. So these are legendary in audiophile land, because many people like the way they sound. One of the other legendary headphone makers are Stax from Japan. They use electrostatic transducers. This one happens to be a large over-the-ear, but they also make products like that in rectangular cans that sit off the ear. And so they don't really have the crushing effects as much, those in particular, as regular headsets. You can see this connector is not a standard connector. That's because there's a very high polarizing voltage to get these electrostatics to work, like your fancy electrostat, AccuStats, or quad electrostats. It requires a high voltage. That's the mechanism. These are just some measurements. These are some measurements showing this is a pretty good response, actually. This one is this one I believe is the Stax. You can see that it's complementary down a little bit where the ear is high a little bit.
What
yes.
are the two traces imply?
These are it's the range. One's on human and one's on replica ears. But
each one has an upper and a lower trace.
I think it was done three times. So that this is by the way, this was done 24 years ago. So the equipment was not up to date. But you can see the general trend. That's that. Yes, sir.
It's interesting that in the studio, usually when we want somebody to listen on a headphone, we may hand them 7506 Sonys or something of that sort. But there are a few, and almost every time it's been a girl, a woman, who has preferred listening on the Stax. Mm. And I think maybe it may relate simply to a sensitivity issue, mm-hmm. too, in that region. It's interesting because it does kind of, you know, it's more suppressed there.
And the Stax are... the electrostatics, until they're overdriven, can be low distortion after designed right.
They are.
Yes. Very clean, smooth, yes. open sound. I mean, once you've heard it, it's like it's hard to go back. Then you've heard what good quality really is.
It's easier to listen to.
It is. There's no fatigue. There's less fatigue, let's put it that way. But they're not the only way to get there. The new Sennheiser, that one, is, and the one before that, the HD 650, those are easy to listen to for a long time. Beg your pardon?
That's what I have.
Yeah, those are good. Smooth, a little laid back. They roll off the highs a little bit, but they're very smooth, low distortion. These are the AKGs. Also, you can see that they're sort of, this is the school of thought where I believe they're compensating a little bit for the peaks in the ear. Not everyone agrees with this. This is just a fashion. this is not trying to be flat either. But this is the AKGK 1000. Here's their pictures. You could try these at a hi-fi store. You'll see they really do sound different. If there are any hi-fi stores left. Okay, and how do you get them to work? There's a bunch, like speakers, there are different drive mechanisms. The typical speaker is, because it's simple and it's cheap and it works, is like a big woofer. You have a coil of wire suspended in a magnetic field, and that diaphragm moves back and forth. Although the trade-offs on micro speakers are different, but that's the basic idea. The second step is you see in in-ear headsets. This approach started in telephony maybe 75 years ago, where you would have a whole magnetic circuit and the armature would bang back and forth. It would be very loud and efficient, very low distortion, very high distortion, low fidelity, but it worked and it was efficient. A modification of that approach, where you have a moving magnet banging back and forth, is used in some of the in-ear headsets, but much refined, and it came out of the hearing aid business and is now used in pro audio. And it's expensive, by the way. Those elements are almost $20 each.
So is the armature attached to a diaphragm then?
The armature itself is what makes the noise. A moving mass makes the noise. Hmm.
Like a paddle or something?
That the original one was like a paddle, yes. And there's a variation now with a more linear suspension. I don't have a drawing of that. That works. That works pretty well now. But scaled down just for in the ear. The original ones were for like a telephone size. Not so good sounding, but efficient.
Is it sound from the movement or from the striking?
It's the movement. It's displacing air like that.
It doesn't actually strike.
It shouldn't strike.
That would be
right. That would be bad. Yeah. Right. Well, it's like a voice coil going all the way back and hitting the back plate. Not good. It sounds bad, and it might wreck the coil your speaker's done. The other way is, just because I think people would be interested in it here, is that the ribbon and electrostatic, the esoteric approaches that are used in speakers are also used in headphones because they sound good. They don't sell a lot of them because they're expensive, but these do sound good. Ribbons and electrostats, if done right, sound very good. There are trade-offs. Maybe they're expensive. Maybe they don't have a lot of bass, but what they get right, they can get it very right. Sounds very good. The advantage is partly just it's a large membrane that's driven all in phase. The force per unit area is high. The acceleration is high. The impulse response is good. Not a lot of bass because it doesn't have excursion. What it does right, though, once you've heard it, it's like, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. And that's why they can sell those. That's for people like us. We might be interested in spending that money, but that's not a mass market item. Okay, now we're going to go through the next couple of slides are a quick overview of the different categories of headsets. Circumoral, we talked about. Those are the big cans go over your head. We're doing all right on time. We covered all of this stuff before. HD650 is the Sennheiser is the poster child for these. These are really good. They sound good and are not that expensive. Maybe $200 or $250. That's your best bang for the buck, actually. That's the standard headset. The next set is the Super Oral. These will fit on the ear, and so you're clearly not going to get a good seal. But that's on purpose. It also can sound good. And there was a, what was it? It was one of the, it was a famous one. I think it was the, one of the German companies introduced a famous one. 414, that's right. Right. Who was the vendor? Was it Sennheiser? The 414, that was the famous one. The first one in the 60s that had this, it sat on the ear. It was very, very fluffy foam. So there was leakage, and it didn't have bass. But it was comfortable, and people could listen for a while. People liked that sound, and so that was really, that's the poster child for that product category. Very good product. But horses for courses, right? It depends what you want. Okay, off the ear. These are the ones we were talking about. These are the AKG K1000, and some of the stacks where the transducers are not crushing your ears. These are pretty good also, but they're very expensive. Sony introduced one like this about 1 year ago that had a little headband that held spheres with a microspeaker in it, like a half inch from your ears, and that's a great approach, but no bass. It just doesn't sell. I suspect it was a Japanese product that they tried to take to the U.S. and it did play, but in Japan, I bet they could sell that. Yes, sir.
Do the ultrasound do this?
Okay, the Ultrasone is an upstart German brand, I believe, that is basically circumoral.
Their little trick is that they
don't position the driver in the center. They move it forward and either up or down. So it has some of that effect where you're getting like you're listening to a sound source in front of you.
But it's circumoral as well.
But it is circumoral. So they're splitting the difference. Generally, the best sounding headsets do not fire straight into your ears for a long, because actually, can anyone tell me why? This is part of the test. Why would that not sound as natural, having the micro speakers firing straight into your ears? Anybody? I told you this is going to be a test.
How are you
hearing?
It's not how you hear, because
time delay at high frequencies.
The high frequencies are shot straight into your eardrum, and that's typically, unless the sound source is right here, that's not typically the way it works. If it's in back, it's shadowed by this thing, and if it's in front, it's going to bounce around through this thing. So that actually, a lot of headset speaker companies just don't get that. They just put it right in the center. It really, ideally, if you have the room, should be off-center, a little forward, maybe up or down. Or Bose does it all. That's the only thing they get right. They tilt it this way so that it's centered, but it's tilted a little bit. And so those are the subtle things. Another product, which I have a slide about, some poster children, headsets in headset land, the Monster Cable Beats by Dr. Dre is also like that. It's tilted a little bit. It's not dead center, and that sounds good. But we'll cover the poster children samples later. This doesn't seem to sell much. People don't want to pay. Although you may find that in the future, and this is jumping to the conclusion, the replacement for headsets, the ultimate headset, is not a headset at all, but an array of speakers that you don't touch. And therefore, it's off the ear again, and you have now the full convolution of your outer ear.
If you add something like a bone phone to this?
That was the one type that I did not put in here, but that is another way. That is, uses bone conduction. So there actually are headsets that try and do that. It's not perfect. The popular implementation of that is the reverse. That was originally in World War II. They had mics that would touch the throat because in a tank or in an aircraft. And then they also had for aircraft little microphones that are tooth mics that would be right in front for signal to noise. Bone conduction is a way to get sound into your head in an ultra-high noise environment. That's another way. You have mics that were throat mics or tooth mics, but also getting signal the other way, receiving, could be done with bone conduction. Now, it's not as efficient, but, you know, if you're in a noisy aircraft, like a fighter is light. There's not a lot of acoustic insulation in a fighter jet because you want it to be light. Civilian aircraft has a lot of that, but a fighter does not because you want speed. So the noise reduction is local. It's headsets and noise suppression active in the headset. So that is another way. That's not on the list, but that's a good one.
I remember the first phone, those bone phones, the first ones had were like a collar.
That's right.
Hung down almost through your collarbones. And those things were wild if you had a lot of bass in your, you know, you really felt them moving around.
There's also a security application where people where they don't want to be seen with earphones, where you have either something like that or like a hearing assistance, like a hearing aid type thing, where you'd have the signal would be received and there'd be a something draped over the shoulders and it would inductively couple to a completely in the canal earphone. So for security reasons, so if you didn't want to see the guy was a Secret Service agent, that has been done, actually. Normally you can tell the security guys because they have the little headset with the wire wrapped around and the suits, you know, you can tell.
So that system you described, does it require some mechanical thing in the ear, too?
It does require, it's like a high-performance version of a hearing-assisted device that you would get in a movie theater, because the Americans with it, it's a long story why it's required, but in a movie theater a certain number of seats are set aside for hearing assisted people or handicapped people. So you'll see sometimes Sennheiser transmitters, IR transmitters, high up on either side of the screen. That will send an IR signal typically to a receiver that may look like a Walkman or something, and the Walkman will, you can wear a pendant that will take that signal from the IR transmitter, goes to a box, the box turns it into a signal, the signal goes to the pendant, and then it makes the jump into the user's hearing aid inductively. In telephony, the handsets have something called a T-coil, which is just an inductor that mates with an inductor in the person's hearing aid. So a hearing aid will have two switches like M or T, mic or telecoil, and you can toggle back and forth. So those telecoils, those things are good because you shut off the microphone. And so in a noisy environment, you're shutting off the acoustical pollution. Same thing for all these security things. Okay. The in-ear, these are the typical the white things you see with the MP3 player from Cupertino. They're okay. They're good for the money. But you can hear them and they can hear you, and there's not a lot of bass. But it's cheap. It's actually really cheap. The next, and I believe this is the last type, is when you take the device and put it all the way in the canal, that is towards your eardrum. There's a lot of advantages for doing that because the volume it's radiating into is not that much. It doesn't need to be that efficient. Number two, you're consistently sealing against the outside. So you keep noise out, and you know you're bypassing the entire outer mechanism. And so since you know that, you can then compensate any way you want. You can copy the transfer function that you would normally get, or if the user wants a flat response, you can get that, anything you want. Typically, the poster child for that they're on there, Edemotic, which is a Mead Killian's company who's a scientific researcher. His products are, if you buy the ones that are flat, are perfectly flat based on research. That is, it has a complementary frequency response that compensates for the lack of this in the signal chain, and those products are very good. I have a set. They're very good. They're accurate. They're not expensive, like $100 or something. Shure has in-ears also. Shure came into that business not from research like Edemotic. Shure came in from Pro Audio. Because if you have an in-the-canal headset and you're on stage, what's the advantage for that? I mean, other than having your own personal mix, which is also nice.
Earplugs.
What's Earplugs. That? It keeps out the other sound. What's for live sound, what's the other advantage?
Lower stage wash.
Yes, but what if you have high stage wash or speakers splashing into your particular space, what do you get if it's really bad?
Feedback.
Right. So that's the nightmare. And Pro Audio, the whole name of the game, or not much of the name of the game, is how much gain before feedback can you get? How loud can you play the system before you get feedback? In the ear, it improves gain before feedback for the system because there's no open loop of a speaker and a mic feeding back on each other. And it also saves the musician's hearing, which is also a good point, because a lot of musicians go deaf.
I think some years ago, Gary Louie was mentioning the Edemotics, some of us, and I looked online, and it appeared as if the one that, and I'm not certain, but reduced, had about an attenuation on average of maybe 15 dB, was actually pretty bloody impressive just looking at what they're claiming for it.
Okay, so that what you're talking about are the Edemotic musicians' earplugs, right? So they have a diaphragmatic absorber that cuts the sound more or less flat with frequency. When you jam earplugs in your ear, there's no highs, right? It doesn't really sound particularly good. Their product more or less takes down wideband, 5 dB, 10 dB, 15 dB. So if you're going to hear music and you're just a little 10 dB too loud, you could wear those. And they also supply the key element, the acoustical resistant element, to many other manufacturers of that same type of device. They're the guys, so buy from them. Okay. They're the ones who invented it. Let's see. Yes. The downside of in the canal is that you isolate, of course. You got great bass, of course. But there's an occlusion effect where if you wear it for a long time, it may not be comfortable. And some people, they're really uncomfortable with that. If you're putting it in your ear for 6 or 8 hours or whatever they're listening to their music player for. The ultimate expression of that is in real Pro Audio, you can get a custom mold made so that it fits perfectly and brings the outlet of the canal headphone all the way up to the eardrum, almost touching. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond the bend in the ear canal. And so that's really, if it's done out of a soft material, it doesn't hurt that much, and it completely locks out all the other sound. And so that's the ultimate. If you wanted to get your ultimate personal listening machine, a good in the canal with a custom mold is the way to go.
So I've got some of those, but not with the monitor elements, but it does have the little
baffle.
Yes, right.
Can we pull the baffle out and put a speaker in there? Is there? Do they sell aftermarket?
Yeah, Edemotic sells both ways. The noise, the musicians' friends' earplugs that drop the noise linearly, mm-hmm. and real in the canal devices that are flat.
Because we already have the soft piece to go in.
Yeah, they sell them with triple flange type stuff. Triple flange seals, mm-hmm. but you can get a custom seal on it.
But the Edemotic products, ET4S or something, their better ones are really good. They have a range of products. Just the reference ones are the ones that are most expensive and built in the U.S. Those are more money, but they're very good. All of their products are pretty good, but those in particular are the best ones.
Westone
and Futurisonics are also pro suppliers. That are very good.
I have a pair of Westone.
Those are good.
Molded in ear, ran about $600 for, and it's the two way, so there's two transducers in it. Reminds me a lot of the sound of the Genelex.
Oh yeah, well I love Genelex. So speaking of multi way, so there you can have one transducer in the canal. You could have two, mid and tweet, mid and low and high. Or some of them, I think the high-end Shure PTH-530 has three, two for the bass, one for the highs. It's a little bulkier, but that's also a real pro product.
It's just money.
It's good. I mean, I think there's a slide later on about the value, but think of what you'd have to pay to get that quality of sound in your listening room. Okay. But those, by the way, you generally want a really clean amplifier. Who was it? It was JJ's talk about 6 months ago, said that if you plug a typical pair of speakers into the white music players, the bass is all over the place. And so you really need an external amp to get the best quality out of it. And there's a whole bunch of those that are good, starting at like 150 and up to 500. Okay, now we've done with the technical stuff. Here's a quick dance through the business side of it. The high-end manufacturing, no surprise, it's in Europe and Japan. I don't think there's any other than Edemotic that are built in the U.S., most things are coming out of Asia. The high-end design stuff and the simulation modeling and all that stuff is here. What makes the high-end stuff better are obviously research and people who know what they're doing. But all these other things that are not quite so apparent, the materials, you can't tell what's in a headset, what the diaphragm is. You're never going to know. But there's a range of special materials and special processing for those materials that really do make the difference. It's not typically what's used is Mylar. DuPont's trade name for PET. There's a whole bunch of materials better than that, but they cost money, and so some of the American brands, and the Japanese brands in particular, will do that. The processing, the way you mold headset elements, that is a black art. There's very few places that know what they're doing. In Japan, there's at least one place, and there's two places in China, and at least one and probably two in Japan. That's it. And probably in Europe, Germany and Austria. For AKG. It's very hard to get that right. There's all sorts of type of drawing of the plastics that is non-trivial, and most factories just bang them out as fast as they can and don't think about it. The other subtle things of winding the coil, adhesive, all these details, most headsets, they pay no attention to it. The flip side of us buying all this stuff from China, all these cheap headphones, is that they're learning a lot very fast. They're not dumb. So you'll see Chinese brands of everything, actually, come out, and they'll be good sooner or later. And we did this to the Europeans after World War II. Japan did that to us in the 60s with our consumer electronics brands and other stuff marched through Europe after World War II. The Japanese marched through the U.S. and the rest of the world with tech consumer electronics. The Chinese are next. These companies are the next. Lenovo already made their move. These guys are coming in white goods like refrigerators, networking equipment. I think these guys are a car company coming soon. At retail, why do people buy this stuff at retail? We are not typical customers. As I've been told by a professor, do not do market research on yourself. We are willing to spend more money to get something better. Well, you know, most people are not like us, fortunately. They'll buy on price appearance for the fashion, a whole bunch of other things that are features, bullet points on a box, nothing to do with fidelity. So these are also drivers of the market. So you have to think that's reality. It's not about fidelity, except for one segment, which was represented here. I worked on this project, and this was an all-out attempt at state-of-the-art. This is the $350 over-the-ear active noise cancellation headset. it's really good. The Sennheiser is probably better, though, but this is really good. It can be done. Sennheiser, with that new one, is reaching for the top of the market. This is an interesting brand. I don't know if we have time. I'll cut it short, but they're all interesting brand stories. This is the number two or three brand.
We'll be back after the break.
We will be back after the break. But this company started 6 years ago. Okay, Sennheiser has been in business at least 75 years. So there's a business here. It's not about building the best products.
Where are they located?
They're Southern California. Hmm. So these guys know their business. And these guys who are selling cable, they could sell ice to Eskimos. So this is a really well-engineered product, if I do say so myself. I was going to bring one. I'll bring one next time.
And I think the Eskimo ice infringes on their patent.
Yes, so that's right. They can sell anything. And so you got to respect that. I mean, they know how to sell. There's a whole replacement market. When you get there are a billion cell phones ship a year. That usually they come with some sort of cheap garbage. Even the MP3 players, they ship with junk. There's a huge inbox. These are no good. There's a lot of replacements out there. That secondary market is big. And so that also is fueling the growth in aftermarket headsets. Oh, this is the segments in the market. This is the one we all think about, sort of audiophile and pro. Pro audio, we talk about this. But there's a whole world of stuff that's out there, like mass market stuff. These are the things that people care about when they typically buy a headset. The packaging, which is not on there. How loud it is. How much apparent bass it has, even if it's not accurate. By the way, the DJ market loves bass, and so that actually is pro, and that's all about big bass. Sony owns a lot of that market. What it looks like, what the packaging looks like, I mean, what the affiliation is, if it's like some fancy pants DJ is endorsing it, like which is Monster Cable's approach. That's what people buy on. Where it is, if they're a Target and the headset's a Target, they buy there. There's another segment that is extremely high performance, but not hi-fi, which is using headsets to measure someone's hearing. That's all about precisely hitting the sensitivity at a couple of tones, 2K, 200, 400, 1K, 2K, 4K, that's it. That's another specialized market. Not a lot of business there, though. This is where the real business is. Oh, this is another one we talked about, ultra-high noise environment, military, industrial, isolation, and active noise cancellation are key. Aviation business. David Clark has headsets with the silicon sealed stuff for pilots. Those are great. They work. They're heavy. They're bulky, but they work. Not a lot of business there. Here's where the business really is. Cellular, VoIP telephony, call centers where there's people selling you stuff you don't need at 4 in the morning. This is the real driver. Actually, this is coming. This is today. This is tomorrow. This means making a phone call over the internet and soon a video call also. Everyone has a PC or some internet-connected device that goes to the cloud. Wouldn't it be great if there was a wideband telephony standard that you could talk to your friend across the world for free and it sounds good? Well, that's already started.
I use Skype all the time in my business.
Skype is extending their model beyond. There's three flavors. Okay, there's old school telephony, plain old telephone service, POTS. The band was 300 to 4K, give or take, 300 to 3400. That's called narrowband. Wideband is what we have more or less now, which is an octave more above and below, 150 to 7 or 8K. That's what we sort of have now. Those standards are just being redrafted now. That's where the market more or less is or will be in a year. There's another layer beyond that that has already started that is super wideband. That's where people, especially businesses, will be looking to have really hi-fi conversations over the internet.
And actually, I'm starting to do some work in the studio where I have my client remotely, and I can play things to them. They can play stuff to me. I can translate it into, say, piano or something, record that into a digital audio workstation, and then send them the WAV file, and they can record something on top, but we can collaborate. We hear good enough that you can hear the guitar.
That's over Skype?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, there's another layer. Skype is also starting to implement this. They're the first big company to do it, of super wideband. That is coming. Skype's fidelity varies a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be good. It's just a matter of getting the idea across.
But wouldn't you want to hear someone in hi-fi across the world? I would. Would you pay extra? I would.
There's the latency issues as far as being able to jam together.
That's true. Yeah. Synchronization's an issue. Okay, I have three more slides because it's been an hour and 14 minutes.
How about if we take a break and come back to that so people will have something to come back to?
Okay, it's three more. Then we could come back after that. We're mostly done.
Okay,
then I'll burn through them quickly.
Sure.
The high sound pressure levels are triggered regulations in Europe to limit noise. It's at 100 dB, which, by the way, is ridiculous, and so that's coming. Also, you don't want isolation all the time. If you're crossing the street and you can't hear a car coming, you're out of the gene pool. I believe it's DBA, because they don't have bass anyway. And then in terms of value, everyone can dispute the numbers here and there, but headsets are your best value. I mean, you can get state-of-the-art or near state-of-the-art for $2,500 gets you about approximately state-of-the-art in headphones. $1,000 gets you something very, very good. To do that in speakers, you're looking state-of-the-art, you're looking at 100K and up. And then this is the future, and then is that we really covered all this. That's wideband telephony with video and audio together is coming. And again, and then the ultimate headset will be no headset. It'll be an array of mics and speakers that's not on your head. That's also for fixed installs where people have a little privacy. That's what people want, that tracks you as you move around. They don't want to wear stuff on their head. And then I'll take any questions now or after the break.